Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Tony Taccone, now entering his 16th year as artistic director of Berkeley Rep in Berkeley, has been with Berkeley Rep for a quarter century.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I think the place to start is with the show that's just opening now, Pericles, Prince of Tyre. Mark Wing Davies is a director, and this is his take on Shakespeare, and this is in at the Thrust stage. So Shakespeare usually has a lot of characters. You'd think the Thrust was the wrong place for it.
I actually like disarming our audience with expectations about what space a show should or shouldn't be, and I think it's kind of obviously I'm doing it primarily for the purpose of trying to find what the best space is for the show. We've done Shakespeare plays in the Thrust before. We've also done quote-unquote, really large shows in the Thrust. The issue is intimacy. The issue is what shows will bear up better, you know, in the Rota, which is more sort of a spectacle space, than Thrust, which provides this enormous ability to sort of be with the actors. If you feel like you can sort of experience the play right along with them, and they're only a hair's breadth away. And so Mark's done a unique adaptation of Pericles. Pericles is the play that basically most scholars would agree that Shakespeare wrote about half of it, the second half. And so there's more license to kind of do with the text what you will, and Mark has done his own personal adaptation of the text. The cast is comprised of a total of 8 actors and 3 musicians. Some of the musicians sort of double up as, you know, a couple of extras in certain scenes. But the point is that it's a play you can do that with because it's driven by a narrator and it's a sort of fairy tale. He's assembled this great group of actors who play multiple roles. But the idea is that the actual way that he's double cast is a way to tell the story in a more imaginative way. Mark is one of the most imaginative directors I've ever encountered. I mean, this guy is—he thinks of things no one on the entire planet is thinking about. So it's been fun to work with him again.
In that way, he's sort of like a Mary Zimmerman type.
He's Mary Zimmerman with a much rawer aesthetic. I mean, Mark likes to mix periods. He likes to mix musical styles. He likes to kind of rambunctiously reinvent the dialogue that the audience is having with the play. Mary is much more of a cohesive. She's almost like a classicist. She adheres to the rules of cohesion and unity and sort of one world. Mark's like 50 worlds going on, and the fun of it is to be in dialogue with his head. He'll stage a fight in a Shakespeare play, and he'll have the actors adding in sort of what he calls like the Batman soundtrack. Pow, bang, whiz, boom. Now, you're watching that, and you're going, that's odd. That's a Batman soundtrack. He's distancing you from a kind of total emotional immersion in the moment. And he wants that to be. He wants that to be going on in your head while you're going like. And for him, he's trying to make specific references to, one, the story, two, your relationship to the story, three, the collective group of images that you're already carrying about fights and violence. So Mark's looking for a Brechtian response. He never wants you to stop thinking about the world you're currently inhabiting versus the one that's being expressed to you in the play.
And at the same time, you're doing it in the Thrust, which is more intimate, which kind of, I guess, in that sense, forces a greater interaction.
Totally. Mark's interested in exposing the magic, letting you see all the sources of the theatrical strategies, the craft, the technique. It's all exposed. Mary is into just kind of creating a spiritual event. Mark's more interested in a rough and tumble, a political event.
How did you find this particular production?
It's never been done before. I approached Mark last year, like I do many artists, and saying, what do you got in your toolkit? We will approach artists as opposed to just like particular plays. I mean, there are certain artists that are so seminal to our aesthetic that whatever they're interested in is something that I might be interested in. So I called up Mark and said, hey, Mark, what are you working on? And he listed like 5 things, and he said, and I have this Pericles, this version of Pericles in my locker, as he called it. So I said, well, what's that like? He said, well, I workshopped it in Florence, Italy, you know, a few years ago, and I really liked it, and I can send you the adaptation. So I read the adaptation, and I liked it a lot. And so we just started talking about it, and there you go.
this is at the thrust. When you're creating a schedule,
right,
how does the thrust versus the rota fit into the scheduling, fit into the choices you make?
Every other show is in the different space. So obviously we go thrust, rota, thrust, rota, thrust, rota, or vice versa. We tend to do four shows in the rota and three in the thrust. So we tend to open the season in the rota. That would imply that the rota shows are the opening show, the holiday show, a spring show, and closing. That puts more pressure on shows that have some spectacle in them, and that seems to line up a little bit better with the holidays and with the opening of the season and with the closing of the season. Shows that are just a bit sort of more grand. Now, there are lots and lots and lots of variations and aberrations and amendments to that theory. My primary guidepost in terms of scheduling and programming shows for certain spaces is the single question, what show fits better for the audience in that space?
At the Thrust Theater, it's three quarters around and you're looking down at the stage. The rota is a proscenium, and you're looking at the stage. How do you determine which shows go where?
It would be too long and arduous a list to go through to let you know what's going on inside my head, and probably doesn't look very pretty. But, you know, there's probably a million factors, from what scope of visual requirements does the play have. If you're doing a comedy and it's at all presentational, you really need to be in the rota, because what you want to do is have the jokes land at the exact same second for every member of the audience. If you're in a thrust theater, Jeff Wales almost always humoring me by visually showing me how you have to play a joke in the thrust. So he says the line and then he pans his whole body from one side of the stage. And if you're in the thrust and you are doing a comedy, frequently as an audience member, you'll hear a laugh start in one part of the house and then sort of fan itself across the room. That's not a great way for any comedy to really operate, but it can work. We're starting off next season with Chris Durang's play, Vanya, Sonia, Masha, and Spike. We're starting off the season with that.
Oh, great.
Which is a fantastic, rambunctious comedy. It's playing on Broadway, and we just scooped the rights. It was really a great thing to be able to do. So that play has to be in the rota. I mean, it's just so full of sort of this rat-a-tat-tat, funny line after funny line. I mean, if you did that in the thrust, I think you'd be really flirting with a disaster, because you'd be subverting the comic intention and the comic rhythm and the comic focus of the play. So it's great that we'll be able to do that in the right. And that, for me, picking that show, I picked it for the rota because I knew it would only work in that space.
Tony Taccone, let's talk a little bit about the season that's passed. Still going on. Well, we'll talk about upcoming
shows. They never
shows
stop, and which is an issue for us now because, you know, really we do – we're going to talk about the list of plays that are in our season, but really we've been doing 9 to 10 plays a year now. The special events that we're doing, which have included, you know, The Wild Bride, some of the more memorable and popular plays that we've done have included special events. And so when I think now as a producer, you're asking me, like, well, which shows go where – there's hardly any time now where a theater is dark. And so that's both created an enormous level of excitement, but also a certain level of pressure for us that doesn't really go away.
Last summer, I think, Emotional Creatures.
Yeah, that was a special event. The Baryshnikov piece a couple of years ago was here. We're actually bringing him back next year. We're very hopeful of that. In one year, the first year that Rita Moreno was scheduled to do her show, Life Without Makeup, she actually broke her leg and had to have a hip replacement. And we had to literally postpone that to the following season. And fortunately, Anna Deavere Smith was a special event scheduled to happen right after that. We just moved her up into the season. Sometimes it works very much in your favor. However, having said that, we lucked out because the fact that she was available to even come was just lucky.
Let's talk a little bit about these previous shows since the last time we spoke. The show that I had most trouble with was something called Troublemaker. Did that come out of Berkeley Rep itself?
Or? It did. Troublemaker was a commission where we hired Dan LaFranc, who is, I think, a wonderful writer. We can talk and argue about this, but I really like the play. Like any new play, I think it was under construction. I would say, and honestly, and this is not a negative thing, but I think we counted this. Of the 200-some-odd pages of the text, 120 of them were rewritten in rehearsal. So that was a rather daunting experience. But Dan is a fantastic writer and very quick on his feet and wasn't very precious about the stuff that he thought worked and what didn't work.
You know, one thing in talking with various artistic directors is that part of the success of a show is not necessarily the quality of the show, but the conversation that happens after the show.
Sure, of course.
You know, so Troublemaker, for all my problems, which had to do with the change of tone.
Oh, yeah, you were one of the people who didn't go with it, huh?
Well, I didn't get – that was one of the two problems. The other problem was that if you're going to do that and create, in essence, two worlds, it takes place in the in our world and
right,
in a comic book
world.
You need to find points of reference, and I felt that in the final act, there weren't enough points of reference. I didn't know who the bad guy was.
You know, that's really interesting. I mean, I it's so funny. I think people were pretty polarized around that. For a lot of people, it was not a problem at all.
Right.
And then for other people, it's like, I'm not accepting that. I'm not going there. And it's almost like they felt like the rules had been changed or something. And they felt like the sort of rug had been pulled out from under them. Honestly, I didn't feel any of that. I feel like, oh, they're just going there and they're asking me to respond in it. I mean, like in this way. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I do think, and I will probably give more of a cautionary warning. I think more and more of that is happening. The writing that I'm seeing, which is of very high quality, by the way, coming out of younger people, they have fewer rules that they adhere to around that kind of aesthetic guidepost. And I think it's because their world, their experience of the world is much more sort of mixed up in that way. How they search for meaning is not really codified by the same kind of rules and regulations or the same methods of understanding that a lot of us older folks have. So it's interesting.
Do you think that has to do with the internet?
I think it has to do with a lot of things. I think the internet's part of that. I mean, I was just in the car today with my 18-year-old who was assuring me that there has never been a bigger generation gap than there is currently ever in time. And he was saying, it's because of the internet. The gap between reality and expectations that are being fed to me on the internet is enormous and something that he just knows that I don't get. And I think he's totally right. I don't get it because I don't experience it in the same way. My molecules haven't been as shaped by that dominance of electronic information just constantly going into my brain. You see it in not just Troublemaker, but anytime we do, I mean, I think across the board, I don't want to make like a big, like reductive statement here because I think there are definitely, like I said, you know, like exceptions to this. But when we have done the work of younger writers who've grown up in this internet world, grown up with a different sort of collective imagination, a different expectation about what fantasy is there to provide for them in their life, you can pretty much guarantee that there's going to be a slightly polarized response in the audience, and it's pretty much around age. Like I said, there are exceptions, and there are crossover, but it's pretty much a guarantee that we're going to get some response from the audience that isn't unified.
How do you, as an artistic director of one generation, deal with being able to determine what actually works for the younger generation?
I have to keep myself what I would call as open as possible. I mean, I have the advantage of being exposed to a lot of younger writers on a consistent basis. I also have the advantage of having three sons, you know, who have kept me on my toes for my whole life. My oldest sons are both artists who don't have the same aesthetic as I do. But we help each other to see each other's work. And they can break down for me what is happening to them and why they express the things the way they express them. So I think with all these things, plus I think a number of people that we hire at Berkeley Rep are younger. So the dialogue is constant between generations at the theater with artists of all stripes, of all ages, and I think it's healthy.
You're listening to an interview with Tony Taccone, who's the artistic director of Berkeley Rep. The other shows that we've seen the past year, Chinglish, of course, went on to China, right?
Massive hit, Chinglish. Everybody loved Chinglish. Yeah, went on to Los Angeles, where it played at South Coast Rep for an extensive run, and then it went on to be the hit of the Hong Kong Theater Festival. I didn't go, but by every account, people came back just sky high. They just thought it was an astonishing event. David Henry Wang is... He called it like the dream of a lifetime. I mean, it was pretty amazing. And then there's this one section in the play where the communist insignia is brought on stage and the audience gasped. It was a huge response. But they also, the things that we were worried about was would the comedy play as well? It played even better than it played here, evidently. And so I saw some videotape of it and I can attest to the fact that it was a ravenously successful event.
When I spoke with my mother who saw it in New York, the set apparently was virtually the same as New York.
The set, but the production was not the same. I really feel like the production that we did was much less broad. It was much more grounded in the human relationships that the play was trying to describe. I feel like in New York there was a lot of pressure to make it into a quote-unquote zany comedy. And I think it suffered that way. I mean, it was well received for the most part, but I feel like when I read the play, I try not to actually see the shows if they've been done before, because I feel like it kind of perverts my view of them, or it doesn't allow me to think in as creative a way. So I read the play and I had a very, very strong positive impression of it. And based on my reading of it, I went after the rights for it.
Tony Taccone, before we move on to next season, Fallaci is still playing through April 21st.
It is.
I understand that went through a lot of changes during rehearsal as well.
It certainly did. I know this new play thing, I got to stop doing this. Even with Pericles, the script's totally different from your grandmother's Pericles. But in any case, yeah, Larry Wright, who was the esteemed journalist who turned his attention to the stage for this show, not the first time he's done a stage play, but certainly the first play he's done, in other words, the first play he's done with more than one character. Fallaci went through a huge change in rehearsal and is going to continue to change. I think in large part you have the issue of a guy writing about two women. And I think that the nuances of what that dialogue is, what kind of interrogation has to happen, in particular in scene one, where this younger woman shows up at Falashi's apartment, and right now there's a big surprise that occurs about three-quarters of the way through the first scene, which is very effective. But I think that Larry's eager to, you know, work on it again, because he feels that there's some steps that he's wanting to explore in a more intimate way about how the younger woman's agenda comes to light more, and that she has a stronger dramatic agenda in the first scene that then pays off like in the second half of the play.
Coming up, you already mentioned one play, this kind of takeoff on Chekhov.
Right, right.
But you've also got another play, which is an original play that was developed at the ground floor, which is Berkeley Rep's play development.
It is.
Called The House That Will Not Stand. So when you're talking about that, another young writer?
A younger writer. I mean, when we say young writer now, we're talking about people who are like 35 years old. So, I mean, but, you know, it takes about 10 years, you know, to find your voice and to mature that voice into something which is dramatically sound. Marcus Gardley came out of Yale. He's from Oakland. This kid's out of Oakland. He's an African-American man who has been writing for a number of years now, and I think this is a truly, truly wonderful play. It centers around six women in a particular time period of American history, set in the Deep South, Louisiana, and it deals with this, what you call a matriarchy. This was very common practice and quite some time ago, where white men would take on black mistresses, and bequeath to them certain parts of their inheritance. So what's happened is that very, very recently this guy's died, and what happens to that household after his death, the sort of struggle for wealth and inheritance and legacy and identity and power between this mother and her daughters, and the sort of competitive female interests, is the stuff of both mythology and American history, and in Marcus's case, poetry. Because Marcus has really been conscious, I think, of the legacy of August Wilson, the great African-American writer who died pretty recently, a couple of years ago, after completing a 10-play cycle about the history of one family in America. So he wrote such plays as Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and Joe Turner's Come and Gone. So he's pretty well known in terms of the lexicon of dramatic work. Marcus, I think, has inherited in some ways that mantle, and I don't think it's wrong to say that I think he was under the shadow of that legacy for a bit of time, and I think this play crystallizes his voice in a way that is both unique and it's really exciting. I mean, I think he's found like an idiom to express himself in a unique way, which is really, really fun and really impactful.
Is that going to be at the Thruster, Rhoda?
That will be, and in the Thrust. That's a play that could have gone either way.
This current season ends with Dear Elizabeth, which is an epistolatory play.
It is, which I'm usually not a big fan of, but in this case, with Sarah Rule, who is one of my favorite playwrights, and the re-entrance of Les Waters back into the Bay Area. I mean, Les is one of my favorite people and a great artist, and he's done so much great work for us. He's now, you know, flown the coop and is at the artistic director of the Actors Theater of Louisville. That combination of Les and Sarah has brought us so many great, great works. And I also really was captivated by the play. It's a description of a 30-year relationship between two of our greatest poets, Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop, and their very complicated, very winning, very profound relationship and friendship that they established over a 30-year period, told entirely through letters.
So they're talking back and forth with one another on stage.
You're talking back and forth with one another on stage. They're sometimes in a direct address. They're sometimes talking to each other through us. It's a directorial challenge, but Les has met it in the way that only Les can. We are co-producing the premiere of this play with Yale Rep. So it was done last fall at Yale, but with the full intention that it would come here. People probably realize if not consciously, then I think they get it when they see that sometimes we are the beneficiary of going the second time out. You know, that we're a playwright in this case, and you always leave time in between the shows so that a playwright has a chance to go back and look at the text and see what improvements that they want to make. And that will certainly be the case here.
It seems like South Coast Rep has a lot of that with Bay Area theaters, too.
Well, South Coast Rep for years had the most ambitious and voluminous commissioning program in the United States. I mean, at one point they were hiring 15 new writers a year to write new plays, of which they said that they were lucky if three of the plays of the 15 were able to be done on their stage, which I think is an indication to your audience about just what the ratio is, right? You know, because it takes a lot of work to create a good play.
Then you've got something called The Pianist of Williston Lane, which is a one-woman show by a concert pianist about her mother.
Mona Golubac, who is a contra pianist herself, which is the single most distinctive feature about this play. You've got a woman who's a concert pianist, an accomplished pianist, who is telling the true story of her mother, who was protected by her parents growing up during the Weimar Republic, during Hitler's rise to power, and shipped to England in the throes of the war years so she could escape the horrors of Hitler's Germany. It's the story of a young girl going to England and surviving the war through music. And Mona tells the story. She's the daughter of this woman, plays much of the music in the course of the evening that her mother played, and it is really moving and quite powerful.
That one, I guess, is Rhoda.
No, you know why? Here's the deal. Mona's not really an actor. I don't want her to have to push. I want you to be in her living room with her fireplace and her books and the picture books of her mother and the songs right there so she doesn't have to sort of become Vanessa Redgrave in order to tell you the story.
And where did that one come from?
That one I got a call from a friend of mine in L.A. who said, there's a play at the Geffen. You got to come down and see this thing. And I don't usually do that, but the person who called me was a former rep employee who I love and who I trust a lot. So I went down there and saw it, and I loved it.
And then you've got Tristan and Isolde, which is another knee-high production.
Well, knee-high left its brand here a couple of years ago with The Wild Bride, and people had an appropriately wonderful response to them. I mean, Emma Rice, who's the director and is the director of Tristan and Isolde, is a seminal artist. I mean, she has got so much joy pouring out of her heart and so much imagination. The way she tells stories, I think, is unique and kind of this hybrid style of sort of marrying. Well, in Wild Bride, obviously, she married like a blues score with a Grimm's fairy tale, with a story theater technique, with dancing, and it was just, you know, very unique and very winning. And so Tristan and Isolde is actually one of the earliest pieces that knee-high did years ago. And while they are here doing Tristan, we're going to be developing a new piece with them based on a book, a children's book by the same guy who wrote War Horse. And he came to knee-high and said, would you adapt this book that I've written? And it's about, I'll just tell you a little bit about it. It's a story of these GIs in World War II who are practicing for the Normandy invasion on a beachhead in England. It combines an English cast with an American cast, so we thought this is the perfect vehicle for us to actually create a production using a mixture of American actors and English actors, and so we're really excited about that. It's called Adolphus Tips, which is the name of a cat in the story. But anyway, knee-high is back with Tristan and Isolde, which is part rock opera, part ancient German myth, and it's a great love story, and so we're excited about that.
Accidental Death of an Anarchist.
Accidental Death of an Anarchist is a probably, it's certainly of the many plays that Dario Fo has written. I think he's written over 40. It's probably one of his top three. At the Eureka, we used to pride ourselves in doing a lot of Fo. And I did a production of it years and years ago, first play in which I cast Jeff Hoyle, actually, and right out of the Pickle Family Circus. And nobody knew he was an actor, and he played the anarchist. So it's a play that I'm very close to. Christopher Bayes, who was here last year with the Molière, with The Doctor in Spite of Himself, and Steve Epp, who's been with us many times, who was the leading actor for Theatre de la Jeune Lune for many years, and he's been here a lot with everything from The Imaginary Invalid to Doctor in Spite of Himself to The Green Bird to Figaro. He's been here a lot, and I think he's one of the great, great comic actors in America. I would have never considered it if the likes of Steve Epp and Christopher Bayes had not been involved.
Two shows, Tribes by Nina Rain. It's a play about deafness directed by Jonathan Mosconi.
Tribes was a play. It was very successful in England a couple of years ago. It was done in New York. Much acclaim. It's a very unique play because it really allows the audience to actually experience a little bit what it's like to be deaf. And it does this with two distinct characters. One character who is deaf, who is actually on stage in the play, who's playing a part of a guy who's deaf, and a character who is going deaf. The journey of that character from being able to hear into the world of silence is very interesting and creates an enormous amount of empathy. There's an issue in the play about identifying with somebody who is deaf and championing the politics of the deaf community versus somebody who's been raised to ignore that in the hopes of being, quote-unquote, normal. It's a wonderful play, and John has all the right instincts and sensibilities for it.
Tony Taccone, the show that I'm looking forward to most, and I think most people who go to Berkeley Rep are, is titled The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures.
Yeah, I wonder who wrote that.
By Tony Kushner. And I guess it's another 3.5-hour epic?
Yeah, it is. The show ran about 3:45 in New York, and I think he is really interested in actually shortening the play. In fact, he's doing it right now. We just had a reading of it in New York last week, which was a fantastic event. I got to tell you, it was hearing that play. We had this amazing cast in it, and Tony was able to kind of hear the play again in a fresh way. And he's deeply involved in rewrites right now. I think one of the reasons why he's rewriting is because the way the play was created, it was a commission, and he wasn't ready. He wasn't ready with the commission when it was due to be done, and so he had to write it in under siege. I mean, the pressure that he was under to sort of crank out the material, because he's Tony Kushner and because he has a – and I say this word with all respect – he's a brilliant guy. I think that word is very overused in our field. Tony Kushner is a brilliant guy. And because he is that way, he created material, enough material that was compelling and interesting that it could hold the attention of an audience. But having said all that, he was really excited. Because I said to him a few years ago, I said, I want to do a revival of Angels in America. And he said, okay, great. But he said, but what about IHO? IHO's what we call it, because nobody wants to say that title for half an hour. And he said, what about IHO? And I said, yeah, okay. He said, you want me to do it? He said, I want you to do it. Because he said, you and I can broker like a new relationship on it. And so I'm very honored and flattered by that. And I've made a commitment to him, obviously, as an artist and a colleague and as a friend. I mean, he's just my favorite writer. He's my favorite writer of plays. And I feel like with certain writers, it's my job to keep them in the field, if I can, and to help them in some way sustain like a life for themselves. This is just a continuation of that dialogue, and I'm really happy and proud we're going to be able to do it.
Tony Kushner goes up against Steven Spielberg. There you go.
Well, you know, that's been an interesting marriage, you know. I mean, you know, when it first occurred during Munich, people were like, really? Is that going to work? But it's because it feels like Mutt and Jeff, you know, a little bit. But the fact is that the complementary talents of Tony's sort of rapacious and sort of intellect with Spielberg's amazing narrative skill sets, I mean, that guy knows how to tell a story. And so the combination of talents has really been fortuitous, I think, for not just them, for all of us. I mean, I don't know if you saw Lincoln, you probably did, but I just thought it was a great movie, and so something's working there.
This story, IHO, is set in an Italian family in Brooklyn.
It is, and it's set in 2007, just at the height of the real estate market, when everything was going boom, 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 not bust, bust, bust. Basically, it's a story of a family, a patriarch, who gathers his family around him to tell them that in the interests of their inheritance, because he's found a buyer for the brownstone that the family's lived in forever at an extraordinary price, he's going to kill himself. And it's in their interest to endorse the decision. Now, this guy is a lefty. He's a long-time trade unionist. He's been a member of the Communist Party for most of his life. His children are politicized. They're all a kind of bunch of lefty, dysfunctional, super intelligent, crazy people. It's written really in the style of Arthur Miller. It's really written in the style of Death of a Salesman in terms of the muscularity of the play, the kind of storytelling that it is, the depth of psychological fracture that it's trying to expose and explore. And of course, it's earmarked with Kushner's singular linguistic skills, his amazing ability to sort of illuminate sort of inner relationships and connections that my mere mortal mind can't see until he shows me. So it's got all the markings of a great family play married to Tony's interest in epic ideas.
Do you think he's finally gotten out from under the shadow of angels?
Yes, there's no doubt. I think the first time he got out for the first time was after Carolina Change. I think that was the play that I think freed him. Whether or not it freed him in the public, it freed him personally. Up until that point, and I think he'll tell you very openly, I think up until that point he was suffering. He suffered pretty severe writer's block, for a long time, I'd say a good 5 years after Angels opened, where he kind of, you know, sustained himself by, you know, outtakes from Angels in America, i.e. Slavs, which was really outtakes from Angels in America, writing essays, you know, doing anything except writing plays. And so I think with Caroline, though, he refound himself. And then ever since then, I think he's been on a track to kind of liberate himself. And now I think this is a major new work.
Did Homebody Kabul come before or after Caroline?
It came after Caroline.
It felt to me like he was getting there but hadn't quite gotten there with that one.
Yeah, I think he was, you know, where with Homebody you could sort of see like the first part was totally Kushneri. And then he wrote that amazing monologue, which he showed me, and I was like, are you kidding me? This is the most amazing monologue I ever heard anybody speak. It was fantastic. But then he felt, well, this is so good, I'll write a play about it. And he did, but it always felt a little like square peg in a round hole, you know, a little bit like a jerry-rigged, you know?
One of the problems is that after that monologue, I mean, the monologue is so extraordinary that it either has to be at the end of the play or by itself.
I know. How do you like, you know, compete with that? It's like, okay, play over. Should have just, like, blackout. And then there were 3 more hours after that, so.
Tony Taccone, weird thing I saw in the paper. There was an article in the New York Times about this musical on Broadway opening called Matilda. And in terms of what the producers were going, they listed as a cautionary tale a show called Billy Elliot, which ran for 3 years, made money, and ran over 1,000 performances. If Billy Elliot, a huge hit, is a cautionary tale, what does that tell us about the state of theater today?
No. Troublemaker's a cautionary tale. Let's reframe this. Okay. I mean, I read that article too, and I just was sort of like rolling in the floor. I mean, are you kidding? I mean, what it does point out, though, is the absolute diametrically opposed value system between commercial theater and nonprofit. In some ways, that article was reaffirming for me because it feels like, you know, oh, good, we don't do that. You know, I mean, Billy Elliot, by my poor theater aesthetic, was a phenomenal financial success. I mean, I remember once reading... Remember when Art Buchwald sued the makers of Star Wars? He had initially invested in Star Wars a little bit.
It was Coming to America.
Coming to America. And they claimed that they lost money.
Right, yeah.
After posting $87 million, and Art Buchwald was like, you know what? You guys haven't lost money, and I'm suing you. Now, there's ways to look at financial sheets, you know, in diametrically, you know, like opposed views. What for you and I looks like a windfall, for some of these guys looks like, you know, it's a total loss. What they kind of exposed about what they were intending to have happen is they want Cats. They want Phantom of the Opera, you know, where you run for 10 to 15 years, you're making people's livelihoods entirely, and then some from one play. I don't think that way.
Well, that's not theater. I mean, it's something else.
It's a form of theater. It's just the theater whose major goal is to make money.
But I've never seen a case where you can manufacture that. It happens.
It does, although, you know, I think like anything that's successful, formulas get built around it. You know, I think this is unfortunately how the commercial world works. You make a successful film, right? There's 20 copycats. One of which will probably make a lot of money. But the formulas get built, and people start imitating because they think, well, that's what's hip. That's what's happening. I think what you just said, though, is like if something is authentic and has a kind of winning apparatus around it, it will find an audience. But that's not always the case, you know. I mean, you and I can sit around here for the next, you know, 4 hours and list shows that – we're ahead of their time. We're failures when they were first done, and then they found them suddenly. You know, 20 years later, somebody's rediscovering so and so, and this is an amazing play.
Well, that's Chicago.
It's Chicago, of course. I mean, it's The Tempest. I'm gonna direct The Tempest this year up at Ashland, and you know, when it was done, it wasn't that popular, you know, and now it's like one of the most celebrated plays of all time.
You're directing The Tempest. What else are you doing in the next few months?
I've written a play with Dan Hoyle called Game On, which is going to premiere at San Jose Rep next April. I'm really excited about that. Really excited about that. And it's going to feature a couple of great Bay Area actors. It's a cast of five, and Rick Lombardo, who's the artistic director of San Jose Rep, is going to direct it, and that'll be on the main stage of San Jose. So that opens around April 1st because we're trying to time it with the opening of the baseball season because it traffics in baseball.
You've been listening to an interview with Tony Taccone, who's the artistic director of Berkeley Rep. Pericles, Prince of Tyre, plays through May. Falacci plays through April 21st. I'm Richard Walensky on Open Book.